Welcome to Conscious Bridge Radio, the program where we explore the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture. Now here is your host, the author of four books, including Be Yourself and Our Spiritual Evolution, Mark Gilbert.
Well, hello again, everybody. Mark Gilbert here, and welcome to another episode of Conscious Bridge Radio, where we explore the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture. Today's program, I'm entitling it, Our Call to Evolve Capitalism, Our Call to Evolve Capitalism. And in a moment, we're going to be speaking with our guest, John Freeman, who's the author of an important new book called Reinventing Capitalism, How We Broke Money and How We Fix It from Inside and Out. Now, first off, I've just got to say, I just finished reading this book, and I was highly impressed with it, and I can't recommend it enough. I don't often do this, but I've just got to recommend that everybody, I encourage you to go out and get a copy of this book. I read the a Kindle version. It's reasonably priced. It's a very accessible read, and I picked up a great number of insights from this book. I was highlighting it left and right. The book's also available in paperback, and links to John's book, as well as his work, which we'll be talking about, is available, as always, on the radio program's website. So please check it out. But I want to take just a moment and tell you why I think his book is important and why I'm encouraging you to read it. There's a couple of reasons that I'll mention, and two of them are really the larger reasons for me. First off, as you know, this radio show is part of the Coffee Party USA's network of programs. And, of course, the Coffee Party was formed to assist in bringing reason and civil dialogue to our political process here in the States. And connected with that are a number of goals the Coffee Party has and some suggested changes to our political process, where we see that our politics have been diverted away from the needs of the people and have been moving toward the needs of corporations and the wealthy. So in other words, money has in many ways co-opted our democratic political system, and some of the biggest changes that the Coffee Party supports relate to the reducing of the influence of money in politics. So if you go to the Coffee Party's website, and the link's on the radio program's website, but it's or Google Coffee Party USA, and you read through its goals, you'll see that they relate to doing such things as campaign finance reform, overturning the Citizens United decision, corporate welfare reform, and ending capital cronyism system. There's also goals towards Wall Street reform and much more. But what I'm getting at is that one of the major concerns of the Coffee Party is the interplay of the role of money in politics. And so if we wish to change or evolve our political system into its really highest expression and highest possibilities, one that's for the people, we need to truly understand the role of money throughout our economy. And this is why I think John's book is so helpful. And the second reason that I'm really highly recommending the book and why I think it's so important gets at the underlying theme of both this radio program as well as the Conscious Bridge website, where you'll find a lot of my writings. And that's all about increasing our understanding of how we are living and moving through an evolving system of life. Evolution, you know, we tend to think of it from our school days as something that's these evolution of simply physical forms. But the more that I've become involved in understanding it, evolution is really a process that's impacting beyond our physical forms. It's also evolving in our consciousness. And this includes our expressions in culture, such as politics, spirituality, and in the case of today's topic, how money and our economic systems are also evolving. John's book, Reinventing Capitalism, is a great primer understanding the evolution of our relationship with this thing we call money. The first part of his book is about our relationships with money and how they've evolved. He then goes on to explore the flaws that we have built into our money system so that we can help us see what needs to be done to fix it. And then he looks at some of the world's challenges to see how our changes in understanding the use of money can evolve to help meet those challenges that we're currently moving through. In a sense, he's sort of painting a basic roadmap for how we need to evolve our relationship with money. And that includes both our inner understanding of what money is and our outer usages of it. Now, I got to admit that John uses the theory of spiral dynamics. And if you've listened to some of my other shows, you know we get into spiral dynamics from time to time. It's a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. Also trained in the subject, and a few weeks ago we had Dr. Don Beck, who was the co-author along with the late Chris Cowan of the book Spiral Dynamics, which built on and popularized the groundbreaking work of social scientist Claire Graves. So I can tell you that what some of the theories, or the theory of spiral dynamics, has been one of the most important theories that's changed my understanding of the evolution of humanity, and I highly encourage you to check it out more. Although we're not going to be talking today at a primer level about spiral dynamics, at least I don't think so. If you're interested in learning more about it, I'd encourage you to check the links out on the radio program. Go back to the show we had a couple of months ago with Don Beck, and become more of a student. Explore it. I think you'll benefit from it. But you don't need to be a student of spiral dynamics to understand the evolutionary changes that occurred with money and the current call for us to evolve an even greater understanding of how money can play a role in our future evolution. So let's bring on John Freeman. John's the author of numerous books, including The Science of Possibility, Future Money, and his latest one that we're talking about today, Reinventing Capitalism. He calls himself a generalist in an age of over-specialization and describes himself as having a passion for propelling the change in thinking that will support us all through the major transitions that humanity faces. He's got a background in information systems. He's a trainer in leadership and organizational development. He has a number of websites which are linked to on the radio website, and he holds a master's in human sciences from Oxford University. He lives in Wiltshire in the UK. And welcome to the program, John.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's wonderful to be here. I'm very grateful both to be here and for the great introduction and for all the wonderful things you've just said about the book. It's very nice to sit and listen to.
Well, I really did appreciate it. I was highlighting a lot, and although I've been a student of spiral dynamics, I've got to tell you, you were opening my eyes to some new perspectives on it, so I appreciate that. But I want to maybe start off with sort of a general question. What led you to writing this book? What were you hoping to accomplish with the whole idea of having us take a look at reinventing capitalism?
There's kind of two strands, I suppose, that led me in that direction. One was having done various things that were kind of more personal and personal development oriented, and having gone through some workshop experiences which perhaps sit underneath the first part of the book about our inner relationship with money. And of course, anybody who's been around personal development in the last 30 years is likely to have come across various things to do with prosperity and money thinking and abundance on a fairly regular basis. So I had that. And then the whole issue of spiral dynamics and its view of money, which also kind of came sharply into focus, of course, in 2008-09. And so it sits with the thing that you quoted about me of seeing my interest, my passion, my role as being to support the preparation for the next phase of human existence, the current evolutionary step that I believe we're taking. And so money just kind of came quite strongly in front of my field of vision as this is something that I have to put out there. And as you'll know, the book kind of leads to a set of proposals which are meant to be the basis for a conversation that would be co-creative about how we actually take that evolutionary step. What do we have to do? Because the systems are very big, very complex, very embedded, and it's not a simple transition to make.
Right. And you know, and I think maybe we might want to start with just a little bit about talking about the different ways in which money is perceived in our modern culture. And without jumping too much into the mechanics of spiral dynamics, I will say that in my own writings, I frequently am challenged with trying to make a point with and use the model without overwhelming people with the model. And so I tend to write in terms of the large cultural groups that are at play in Western society today, usually defining them as traditional, the these are the people who are, conservative and, the fundamentalist religious people and such. And you call them the stage four in your book. And then the second group that's major in play in modern society is what I often call the modern materialistic or scientific people, or also the Wall Street people. These are people who see everything is money and matter and define things in that sort of term. You call it stage five thinking. And then the third one is the postmodern or cultural creative group, or those who are more involved with the egalitarian type systems, and they're stage six. And so what I really see is that although there are lower levels below that, which you get into in your book and Spiral Dynamics gets into, these are the major groups that are sort of bumping into one another in modern society, and they've each got their own ideas about how money is at play and money is a motivator for them. Could you speak to just a moment about how you see each of these stages looking at money and how it's a motivator for them and how their differences are impacting some of the challenges that we're faced with? It's a big question, I know, John.
Well, it is, but it's a good place to start. And if with the kind of presentation that you've just used, if the traditionalist perspective is set as being something that's been kind of around on the in the Western world for several hundred years, in American terms, certainly since the founding, that at that stage, in the traditionalist stage, money is a vehicle, a means of exchange, it's a structure, it's a process, it's an ordering system for the way that we do commercial transactions. And it's subject to a lot of strong legal or possibly even moral precepts about how we relate to each other and what is fair and good and true and honest. And so the stage that comes after that, the one you refer to as modernist, has been perhaps strong in the last 150 years. It relates, as you say, to the material world and the huge triumph of first industry and then technology in its kind of modern technological forms. And in that, the value of money, the positive side of it is it's an incentive system. It's the thing that supports people who have vision and strategy and entrepreneurial skill and wonderful ideas, and that the ones who potentially make the best products and penetrate the marketplace in the strongest way will be also the ones who gain the greatest rewards. Unfortunately, that has a kind of a flip side, which is that materialism can turn into greed, and money shifts from being a means of making things happen to being something which is seen as the goal of making things happen. And it starts to have a value which doesn't actually make sense, because money isn't real in the way that we often think of it as being. If you took away all the money in the world, everything in the world would still be here. Everything that grows, everything that's been made, and all the people and all the relationships would survive. So you could take the money away and you could put the money back, or you put half the money back, and on the ground nothing would change. Only some kind of artificial relationship that money represents would change. But because orange, that's the stage five color, the materialist perspective turns money into a goal and an end in itself, and because people become motivated, they measure their status and their success by the money rather than by the achievement of the things that they produce the money with, it becomes distorting, it turns into greed, it turns into much more serious exploitation in many ways. And it also led in the last 50 years of that system to the development of ways of manipulating money on paper and in digital form that were even further disconnected from any form of reality. And that is the way that the crisis of 2008 developed. And we still have all those mechanisms in place. And we have a severe danger that there will be another crisis because we didn't really fix the system 6-7 years ago. And then what comes after the modernist system is the kind of postmodernist humanist perspective, where there's a reaction, in fact, to all that materialism that seems to have lost all connection with our human beingness and our relationships and our care for one another. And that gives birth to even things like a science of psychology and sociology. So you couldn't have had a grave system or a spiral dynamics without the stage six thinking. But in economic terms, it starts to put a big tension that is very highly visible in the world right now around the reaction of those who have seriously lost out, particularly in the last half dozen years. A considerable distaste for the kind of the 1%, 99% split. All of the energy that is very much central to Bernie Sanders' campaign, all of that is representative of stage six. And it's necessary, and it's a rebalance against the materialist system, but it also has a bit of a tendency to lose sight of the fact that you don't want to destroy the material system. You don't want to destroy the economy in order to move to the next stage, because we actually benefit a lot from the things that it creates.
Mm-hmm. You know, we'll come back to Bernie in a second, because I did want to ask you about him as well as some of the other presidential candidates that are at play here in the U.S. right now. But one of the key things that that I think is critical to for the listeners probably to realize is that these three levels that you've just talked through and their role with money, that it was actually in the challenges that came out of each one of the levels led to the birth of the next level. That is the traditional view or the traditionalist, the people felt constricted by that to a degree and wanted to break out to a degree of individualism, which led to the role of the changing role of money to a degree, i.e. the Wall Street mentality or the capitalist mentality of wanting to have more personal possessions was birthed through the idea of breaking away from the limitations and the downsides of the traditionalist model. And similarly, the Wall Street greed that you talked to was also, and the dissatisfaction that people felt in terms of the continuous chase after material wealth, led to the birth of the new expression of the postmodern or egalitarian type level or cultural creative level. So it's actually the challenges that come with each level that lead to the birth of the next level is the point that I'm trying to make. And where the point I got from your book and where and why it's so important that we're that we need to evolve the capitalistic system to its next expression is because even out of the postmodern level, we're now birthing into what Claire Graves called that momentous leap and, you know, the great tier shift to tier two consciousness, or in your case, you know, levels seven and eight stage thinking. It's really the challenges that we're currently faced with, that which are our call to that higher level. And so what are some of the, A, would you agree with that analysis? And then B, assuming that you do, what are some of the challenges that you're currently seeing out there that are really evidence that we're needing to reevaluate what capitalism is and rebirth it in some new form?
I totally agree with that presentation. It's absolutely central to Graves, to spiral dynamics, and to the way that I see the evolution of money in the book. And there are a lot of aspects to what's happening currently that kind of they're bigger than than the money, but the money represents very many aspects of what's happening. What is different? Why did Graves talk about second tier and first tier, and why did he talk about a leap? It's because the shift that we're in now is bigger and more complex than any shift that we've had before. Because at this point, in order to cope with the number of people on the planet, the number of different kinds of thought systems that are living in different parts, even if you just took one city, let alone the planet as a whole, in order to cope with the speed of change, the global complexity, the things that we've damaged in terms of our sustainability, all of the multiple problems that we are currently facing demand a much bigger shift in how we think, how we feel, how we approach the world, how we deal with problems, all of which come into what's required in our next stage with money. The systems that we use for our money were originally designed by people with the traditionalist way of thinking. They were then kind of built on and bent out of shape as much as they possibly could manage by the modernist system, and they're now very much under attack from the postmodernist and egalitarian systems. And so in order to cope with the problems that we're facing, we have to integrate, we have to be able to manage a world which actually needs all the positive aspects of the orderliness of traditionalism, the strategic striving improvement that comes from the modernists, and something which takes care of people and relationships and how we treat one another that comes from postmodernists. We've got to get all of those into a new box where they can all successfully work with each other in a way that the current system doesn't allow them to.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I know that we're leading towards your proposals, but before we get there, I think there is a common theme in the proposals that maybe we ought to talk to, and that's that as we make this momentous leap to tier two consciousness, or we make these shifts. First off, I've got to acknowledge there was a central point in your book that I thought was so critical, is that when we're making the shift, one of the important aspects of the shift to the next level is the awareness of all of the other levels, all of the needs that you just described of the various world views that are at play, and that we have to maintain some level of success in each of those financial dimensions to meet the needs of those levels. So it's not simply replacing capitalism with something else. It's replacing capitalism with a very complex system that allows the needs of the traditional, the modern, and the postmodern to be met while we make this shift to a higher level, which adds a layer of degree of complexity and difficulty, obviously, to that kind of shift. But as we move to the higher levels of thinking, what are the characteristics in your mind, John, of that level, and what's our new role with money? What's it got to look like as we move into the future? You know, you make a great point in the book that sometimes when people think you're pushing against capitalism, you're wanting to go to communism or something like that. And that's not the case. We're really talking about an evolution of the capitalistic system to its next incarnation. What do you think that looks like, and what are some of the key characteristics in that as we move to this higher level?
Well, the key characteristics do all arise from what you've just said. And I'd like to make one slight distinction from the way that you've just introduced it, which is that the problem as it stands is complex. But the solution doesn't have to be. And I believe can't be. Actually, we've got to find a way of releasing that complexity in such a way that there's much more of an ability with the coming system for it to be self-organizing and self-balancing and to have elements of a kind of a natural design and an ecology where what goes on within it has a flexibility and a flow to it that enables it to manage the complexity internally. One of the mistakes that humanity got steadily more into with modernism was we got really impressed with our brains and we got really overambitious in how much we thought we could control and manipulate the world. And the effect of that is that actually we're discovering how badly we do that in some cases, particularly when you talk, say, about the ecology and the management of resources. So what needs to happen is that the intelligence of the system needs not to be one in which it's a kind of an external control. It's actually something that's got to inhabit the shape of the way that the system is constructed, so that it isn't subject to distortions and manipulations. So in some cases, that will, rather than kind of introducing new laws, it might often mean taking away laws which keep things stuck and which support vested interests and which play into everything that you've talked about in relation to money and politics. The idea with communism was, in theory, and of course it's never been implemented in practice, the idea in theory was that you were going to give power back to the people. But the way that was done didn't succeed in doing that, because empowering people tends to be quite difficult for governments. It goes very much against their grain. Governments tend to think they're better at it than people are. And actually, part of what will come when we invent the new forms of capitalism, and there are very many parts of the model that are already out there in spiritual capital, or in the work of Charles Eisenstein, or in people who are working a lot with commoning as ways of alternative economy. People, you know, there's lots of pieces of the puzzle, but what actually will be required is a very flexible, multi-tiered or multifaceted form of economy, which makes it possible for all sorts of different people to do all sorts of different kinds of things without causing damage to others. So if, you know, that may sound a little bit like it could be a mess, but in fact, what happens when you create those freedoms and those self-organizing possibilities, if you set up the surrounding kind of containers correctly, is that much more of people's innate intelligence starts to reveal itself in the way that they act within the system, because they're not being pressurized to act irrationally, which is what happens at the moment, where a lot of the forces that are at play on people's existence mean that they can't behave as they naturally would, just using their own inbuilt intelligence. Is that making any sense to you?
Yes, it is making sense, and I want to pick up this thread in just a minute. We're gonna take a short break, and we'll come back and speak a little more with John and about reinventing capitalism. But let's take this break on the Coffee Party USA Radio Network, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Debbie Lynn Molyneux, president of Coffee Party USA. I hope you're enjoying this program, which is part of the Coffee Party's radio network of shows. Have you ever wondered exactly what is the Coffee Party? Well, have you ever brought up the subject of politics and watched as people roll their eyes? Well, Coffee Party is an all-volunteer nonprofit to encourage respectful conversation around politics. We want people to connect with each other in a more meaningful way. Coffee Party supports reforms of our electoral, campaign finance, government accountability, and tax systems. We also promote cultural changes to address political disengagement, polarization, and misinformation. Won't you come join us? Check out our website and find out how you can get involved as a member and a volunteer of Coffee Party USA today. Help bring civility and reason back to our political process. Go to coffeepartyusa.com to find out more. That's coffeepartyusa.com. Thank you.
Hi, Mark Gilbert again. I hope you're enjoying this radio program. I invite you to also check out the Conscious Bridge website at www.consciousbridge.com or see the link on the radio program's website. There, I've been sharing my exploration of the evolution of spirituality, politics, and culture for the past 6 years. You'll find descriptions and links of all four of my books, as well as years of articles, free audios, videos, listings, and links to numerous resources. And be sure and sign up for my newsletter as well. If you do, you'll get a free gift from me. All of this and a whole lot more at consciousbridge.com. Now back to our program. Welcome back to Conscious Bridge Radio. This is Mark Gilbert again. We're speaking with John Freeman. John is in the UK and is the author of the book, The Reinventing Capitalism. We are speaking about the fact that we've been looking at the fact that we've been moving through some changes in how we view the role of money, and that the current challenges that are out there on the planet are evidence that we need to perhaps reinvent our role once again to take humanity to a higher level in its possibilities. And John was talking before the break about the shift to the more systems-based view. I would first just appreciate the reframing of my question from seeing it as a difficult thing. I think the complexity sometimes can be overwhelming in our minds, but I appreciate the fact that there is a degree of simplification and fluidity in the nature of the shift that occurs, that when you move into seeing how all the pieces come together, there is sort of an aspect that also allows you to release some of the pessimism that might come, and the ability to make that shift, that it actually, now that you can see how the pieces are working together, it actually brings a degree of optimism. In fact, I had a lot of optimism coming out of reading your book, John. But I'd like to speak a little bit, if you would, about the some of the examples that you're currently seeing as evidence that we're moving to this new kind of capitalism, or that there are actually these shifts that are already occurring. You touched a little bit on that before the break, and what are some of the evidence of things you see now that will point as sort of a roadmap of some of the things we may want to grow in the future?
I guess I would point to some of the conversations even that predated the crash. There's been a movement. I'm not sure how much it's penetrated in the States, but in Britain and Europe, to a thing called transition towns, which was very much encouraging of localization of economy and creating some degree of independence and insulation from the global economy, and some degree of resilience, potential support in the event that the global system ceased to function. And then, as I referred to before, people developing kind of other means of exchange that get away from the ways that money have been used. The ownership concept has shifted in commoning, and the ownership of an intellectual property. I mean, there's a book which some people may have come across by Frederick Laloux, which has a parallel title to mine, called Reinventing Organizations, which he has been putting out this new way for businesses to function and businesses to organize themselves internally in a self-organizing way. And he has been putting, he put his book out originally on a kind of give me what it's worth basis, and he's been building a platform for people to work with his material that has been developed as a wiki and which is putting all the intellectual property into the commons. So those kinds of models are already kind of happening in small and big ways all over the place. There's you could point to different ways of structuring lending and debt that showed up in the Grameen Bank that Muhammad Yunus got Nobel Prize for, and which was about microloans in order to stimulate economies in, and particularly women becoming entrepreneurs in places like India and Pakistan. There's lots of these kinds of initiatives that have taken place, which are altering the way that we think about money. They're localizing it. You know, part of this, the shift that is going to make a much more responsive planet possible is it's something called the principle of subsidiarity. And the principle there is that no decision should be taken at a higher level than that which is required to implement it. So what it does is it means that lots of things that people think that governments have to do or cities have to do start getting pushed further down the chain to more local levels. And that means that people can respond to their own conditions and their own needs, and they can manage their own economic situations and systems with much more of a sense of empowerment and freedom from central government and the big forces that kind of get everything stuck in quite monolithic and silo-oriented ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm. What about in the area of corporations, John? You've got some great examples in terms of the, you know, money systems and lending and so forth, but that might be evidence of us moving. But in your book, you point to some of the problems that the current ways in which corporations are structured are causing some problems, and we need to revisit that. What are some of the things that in your mind maybe are ways that we need to look at how the incentives of corporations need to change? And do you see any evidence out there that we might be moving in that direction?
Well, I certainly see evidence because the conversation is happening. There are lots of people talking about multiple bottom lines and B corporations, and, you know, conscious capitalism and John Mackey's work that kind of extended his what he developed in how he ran Whole Foods. There are companies, corporations, which have built themselves around those multiple bottom line ways of thinking. And there's lots of good evidence that companies which work that way actually are more successful, because they tend to be more responsive to their customers, more in touch. They create better relationships with the people who work with them, so there's more loyalty and less churn and all sorts of things that those models are effective at. But the thing that in fact mostly stops that the shift in that direction happening quicker than it currently is the way that we think about ownership and money. Because somewhere along the line, the way that companies got set up was done for the benefit of the people who had capital. And that's what the capitalist system is. It says that those who have money will have the right to make more money by owning all the ways that money gets invested to be a productive process. And that's actually a distortion of any kind of real relationship, because actually somebody who supplies capital is just a supplier, and they should have really no greater status than the person who supplies raw material, or the person who supplies expertise, or the person who supplies labor. They should sit in parity alongside each other. And the way the legal system and the corporate structure is set up is it puts the people who have the money in the position where it's perceived that the right thing to do is to run those organizations for the benefit of the money and the people who have the money. And that's the fundamental of why our business systems get bent out of shape and make very bad decisions, and particularly why they've got more and more short-termist in their thinking. So it's become more and more difficult to think about anything which is sustainable at any level, because of short-termist thinking and a belief that the goal is to grow money.
Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing you say then, John, is that even though examples like John Mackey with Whole Foods and such may move to more outcome-based goals that would lead to higher levels of possible expression, those companies as outliers are stuck in a system that's still limited by the old rules, the old incentives that they're competing with other companies for. So until the systems maybe addressed in a little way, it's going to be hard to move a lot of the corporations to moving towards more humanistic and care-based economy. Is that a fair assessment of what you're saying?
It's certainly slowing it down. It's slowing the transition down, and it's making corporations behave less intelligently in all sorts of ways than they might.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that was a eye catcher for me in your book was the fact that, you know, we often get mired down here in the States, I don't know if it's the same over in the UK, about this debate over deregulation and regulation. And you were making the point that the whole argument on that we're always chasing the tail. We're always coming in after the fact and putting rules in to try to fix the problem that existed previously, but we need to somehow or another restructure the oversight to address the problems we hadn't even thought of yet. And I thought that was a great point, that we somehow it's like we need to somehow or another put in place, and I'd love your thoughts on how this could actually occur, that we structure oversights, controls, and reportings in a way that's not for what was done in the past, but puts incentives for them to say what they're doing more in an outcome basis for society in general. Am I getting your point correctly?
Well, yes, absolutely. And you've in fact, I think, framed your question in very much towards the answer which I would give, which is that our regulation and our legal systems, they've been constructed to put into very tight rules and words all the processes that people are supposed to follow that will supposedly guarantee better outcomes and fairer outcomes and so on. But of course, human beings being extremely inventive, and particularly the fifth stage system, the modernist system, always wanting to out-strategize any of the traditionalist rules, what happens is people continuously invent newer and better ways to break the rules in order to achieve what they want to achieve. Sometimes those things they want to achieve are good things, and sometimes they're not. But you used the word outcomes in your question, and that is actually what needs to be expected of people. But instead of having kind of legalistic arguments about did you break this precise rule or did you not break that precise rule, and paying lawyers huge amounts of money to tie each other in knots around those rules, that whole process would potentially be simplified if the what we looked at was, what was your intention in taking that action and what was the outcome? And if the intentions were good but the outcomes weren't, then you can be more lenient. But if you judge that the outcomes were unfair then or bad, then potentially that's when you have to say, well, you've got to make that good in some form. So you start to bring human judgment back into the system in place of mechanical, almost mechanical rules.
Okay. And, you know, in your book, you eventually get to the point that there are a number of proposals. I think you list 36 proposals that we need to both look at on both the inside and the outside to evolve our system to its next highest level. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious as to although you make the point that they need to occur almost simultaneously, and in reading that, sometimes it's difficult for me to wrap my mind around a simultaneous action of all 36 of them occurring at one time. Which are the ones that maybe in your mind, as you've thought about it, are the most important, or ones that are the salient ones that you'd like to highlight for our audience that are the real things that we need to evolve on both the inside and outside to evolve our capitalistic system?
Well, I'd firstly say that in a way, I'm kind of I apologize if I've given the impression that they all have to happen simultaneously. I think we have to work on them all simultaneously.
And
we have to we have to respond to the most urgent problems as they come up and kind of deal with them one at a time, because this is going to have to be a transitional process. You know, one of the things that's always very scary when people start talking about systems, and, you know, when you look at what happens when people thought you replace capitalism with communism, is the notion that you have this kind of revolution. And then after the revolution's happened on day 2, 3, 4, suddenly everything worked perfectly under a new system. Well, we don't have an option that's even remotely like that. We have to start where we are, and we have to work towards the future. We have to take off the constraints that we can take off, where we can take them off, as soon as we can take them off, and that might depend on where conversations can happen. Some things are capable of being done, say, within a country level, you know, that Britain or the USA could change their own internal relationships or work with their own money systems to start loosening what happens within the country. But some things people perceive as being, you know, all about, oh, well, then we're going to lose our market position and our competitiveness and all of that. And so there are some problems that eventually will require a global conversation of the kind that has been so difficult to have around climate control. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, picking out a kind of, you know, what, I don't know, what would be the first thing that I would want to pick out. I think some of the big ones are out there, and we need to do more of them, like balancing stakeholder needs that I just referred to. Some of it could be, this is where I'm going to maybe line up with Bernie Sanders. I think that there are two things that could happen quite quickly, and one of them is the Tobin tax, so that you actually take all of the heat out of speculation and kind of computers running numbers up and down and manipulating the economy in ways which have no particular logic except that they're known to be successful in making a profit for the person who runs the computer system and puts the money in that's manipulating. Mm-hmm. The other thing, of course, that Bernie has talked about is bringing back some kind of relationship, some kind of tether that holds money in a kind of relationship to reality, to what's there on the ground. And all of that got particularly, well, it firstly got bent when we got rid of the gold standard, which could probably do with being replaced by something a bit more sophisticated. But it particularly got broken when we turned the banks into casinos, and the Glass-Steagall Act that people mm-hmm. quote, there needs to be a separation that stops that inhibits banks from the level of speculation, and that insulates money that people need to use from money which is being thrown into the casino.
I want to come back and speak just a little bit more. You mentioned Bernie and his proposals, and I assume you've been looking a little bit at the American presidential candidates that are out there. And it's interesting that the ones that are seem to be getting the most traction right now are Donald Trump and Bernie, and then Ted Cruz. And I'm wondering if you see any connection between our financial crisis and the rise of these non-traditional candidates, and how that might be playing out in terms of our evolution in this area.
Yes, I don't know too much about Ted Cruz, but I think the Trump-Sanders phenomenon has a fairly clear message in relation to the evolutionary journey that we've been talking about. And that is that the politics as it has been, and the candidates that represent particularly the core modernist way of thinking in its different forms, they're not coping with the problems that are being presented to people in terms of the 99% and the 1% and the squeeze that's been happening to middle America and the middle class, and that that over 40 years actually standards of living have not risen, and mm-hmm. in some of the more marginal areas, large marginal areas, people are getting horrifically squeezed, and what that's producing is a kind of there's two different reactions that are both based on the fact that people don't think that the modernist system is working, and the Trump reaction is to go back to stuff which is in a way older and more primitive and more angry and more backwards and really quite scary, I would say, from my point of view, in terms of the motivations that it's trying to speak to in people, but where it is capturing something which has to do with dissatisfaction. Whereas Bernie Sanders is going the other way. He's taking it more into the territory of what we need to be evolving into, and representing more of the postmodernist egalitarian stage of values. So the old school is kind of struggling because the middle ground, politics is so often about who's going to capture the middle ground, but the middle ground mm-hmm. ain't there anymore.
That's very true. That's very true. And so, do you see a role in Bernie's message that is moving us to this higher level? Or I'm here. It's interesting. We had Don Beck on the program a month or so ago, and I know that you know Don, and Don actually was throughout a line that made me challenge my perceptions on Donald Trump, that he actually felt like Donald was somebody who was hooking us at the lower levels of understanding to move us to the higher levels of understanding, that he had actually, there was an aspect to Donald Trump that I had not really looked at before, but I just put that out there is because it still is challenging me when I listen and watch Donald Trump. But Bernie seems to be someone who is moving us to this, higher levels of understanding. Would you agree with that? Or what are your perceptions on these candidates beyond what you just stated?
Well, I haven't yet found it possible to share Don's opinion of Donald Trump. I have huge respect for Don, but I don't see the evidence. I think there's in a way he's making a leap of faith that I can't say that I would be able to make, which is that, yes, Trump is kind of exposing the underbelly, but I don't see the evidence that he's going to use that to leverage it in order to shift to something which is better. I see far too many personality deficits, which I would say make him appear to me to be quite incapable of that level of shift. Mm-hmm. And even if that's his intention, it's a very dangerous strategy, because if you put out those messages that say, I'm going to do this, you know, I'm going to make America the biggest, strongest country in the world again, and we're going to have an even huger army than the one we've already got, you make yourself a hostage to fortune with all those things. Then how do you do what, even if he has the intention to do something different, how's he going to do that? Where's the base for that going to come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't disagree with you at all, John. I put that out there because it threw me for a little bit of a loop when Don made that comment, and I've been trying to revisit my thoughts on Mr. Trump as well. Mm-hmm. Just a reminder, everybody, we're speaking with John Freeman. He is the author of Reinventing Capitalism, and we have been talking about the whole aspect of looking at our system as a call to move to higher levels of being and change in terms of our system. And I just have a couple more minutes here before we wrap up, John. And I guess one of the things I'd like to ask you is, what have I not asked you, or what point would you like to get out that I think is crucial from your writings and from your studies that you think our audience would benefit from knowing that I've not elicited from you yet?
You've asked me a lot that's covered a lot of ground. I think the one thing I would maybe want to emphasize a bit more than we have done so far is how important our own individual inner journey with money is, and how the attitudes that we have to money personally and the way that our emotions have been shaped by our culture and our upbringing and so on, how much they affect the mindset that we bring to these issues, and how much they affect our ability to think in ways that will get us out of the box that we've been in order to successfully invent a new and better system. Because it actually means each of us letting go of the things that we've been caught up in. You know, it's very easy to blame the bankers and the capitalists and so on, but actually it was ordinary folk like you and me who got caught up in buying houses and selling houses for a profit and thinking that we could make money just by doing that, as if we'd somehow increased the value of anything on the planet, when actually that was a mythology that we were sold that caught us up in treating money as a thing in itself and something that we could grow, when actually you can only grow stuff by planting it or making it or doing something real. So all of the mechanisms that have fueled our own inner thinking, the ways that we're fearful around money, the ways that we look for, or we're the ways that we're suckers to somebody who sells us a free lunch, or promises us free lunch when there's no such thing as a free lunch. Mm-hmm. All of those interior systems, if we can do the work with those as well, we will help free ourselves and our own consciousness in order to support the change that needs to happen in the bigger systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I hear you saying is that a lot of it is self-exploration, is to looking at what our own consciousness is and what our own issues are. It's only in that exploration that we can start seeing where our limitations may be, so that we can start freeing ourselves from them and move ourselves to the higher levels of our capabilities. What gives you optimism, John, as you look out at the planet? And, you know, there's a lot of things going on. When I was reading your book, which I do highly recommend to people, and again, look at the links on the website, and it's a wonderful read. But one of the things that I think you make the point that you're an optimist and you see things moving in a positive direction. But a lot of times you have to outline where we are. And sometimes the outlining of where we are can sound very pessimistic and very challenging to us. But what are some of the things that give you optimism that we truly will move to these higher levels of and reinvent capitalism and evolve it to its higher level?
I guess aside from it being my kind of natural my natural disposition, I do have considerable faith in what human beings are capable of when they're given the conditions to express the best of themselves. We're a phenomenally inventive, imaginative, naturally caring species, and I'm optimistic that if more of what impedes us expressing that were to be taken out of the way, we would achieve things that we can barely imagine at the moment. And I feel that even, you know, the pessimism for me would be things might collapse. They might go really seriously pear-shaped in the next year or two, and it could get really bad. But my faith is that what we have built as a platform for ourselves in terms of our knowledge and our communication systems, that we have what it takes to recover from that and to get it better next time, to not repeat the mistakes that we've made in the past.
You know, you brought that up, and I was going to reference earlier, and although we're running out of time here, I had recently read a book by progressive talk show host Tom Hartman, who wrote a book called The Crash of 2016. And in his book, he outlined a four-generational cycle that we go through of the financial elite is taking control of our system to the point that we rebel and take power back from them, and then we over time forget and they take power back again, and we go through this cycle over and over. And that's the gist of his book, and that we are at another point of cycling through what he calls the crash of 2016. But even he has a degree of optimism, and I think it all starts, as you said, with the awareness, the understanding of what's going on, and holding to that higher possibility of what's going on the planet. What helps you stay anchored in an optimism, John?
Well, I don't always, you know, I have my moments of doubt.
Don't we all?
And pessimism. I think that's probably a good thing. It's a reality check. Otherwise, I'd be in a kind of Pollyanna state. And what keeps me going? I don't know. It's a sort of a very fundamental belief about who I am and why I'm here. And given that I have there's a whole other conversation that we could have about kind of souls and incarnations. I believe that I chose to be here at this time and that I've got, you know, something to say and do about what happens. And I don't think I came here for nothing.
Well, maybe we'll have that conversation at another time. That's certainly something that I could certainly delve into, and that's based on my background and the books I've written. That's something that I'm extremely interested in. Any last words, anything else that you want to get out that I haven't asked you about today that I think you think is essential for the listeners to be aware of in regards to your book or your message?
I think we've covered a great deal, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity. Thank you, Mark.
Well, I so appreciate you being on the program today. We've been speaking with John Freeman. John is the author of the book Reinventing Capitalism, How We Broke Money and How We Fix It from Inside Out. And it really is an inside and out issue and way in which we can address this. So I want to thank you, John, for being with us today. And I thank all our listeners for listening in on Conscious Bridge Radio here on the Coffee Party USA network. We'll be back in a few weeks with another program. But in the meantime, I hope that you've enjoyed this conversation. Please check out the website for links to John's books and John's work. And we hope that you support it and certainly check out the book we've been talking about today. I think you'll benefit from it and get a lot out of it. I know that I did. So thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. Take care and goodbye. And until next time, this is Mark Gilbert signing off for Conscious Bridge Radio.